Joining us on the Gabriel Pizza Hotline. How are you doing this morning, Duke?
I am well. How about you guys?
You know what? We're good. Game two did not quite live up to game one. I thought that was a nice sort of a setup to a great game two. But let's go through it. We'll go through it in backwards fashion. So we'll start with the Bills-Kansas City game. At the end of the day, after the Bills got out to the 9-0 lead, it looked like, okay, they are set to go. And then was it just a matter of Kansas City kind of doing what the Chiefs do every playoff, kind of get behind the eight ball, get themselves focused, and then after that it was, I don't want to say one-sided, but they were comfortably in the lead the rest of the way.
Yeah, I had to laugh. I thought maybe Sean McDermott told his kicker to miss on purpose so they wouldn't go up double digits, because you know that's the kiss of death, right? The last four playoff games now, the Chiefs have gotten down effectively double digits in every game and have come back to win by double digits, which is a remarkable story. But yeah, you know what, at 9-0 you did start to feel a little bit like at the very least this is going to be a real challenging night for the Chiefs. You know, we look back to last week, despite the fact that Mahomes didn't play the whole game there, they only scored 22 points and you know, certainly didn't look like they were completely in sync. And then something a flip switched after that 9-0 lead, and then all of a sudden it was just an avalanche of big plays. And I know Buffalo tried to play zone, figuring that might be the way to kind of limit Kansas City's ability for big plays. But just with the speed of Hill and the ability for Kelce to find those big openings, all of a sudden, you know, could see Buffalo, you know, reeling a little bit. And then I think the really big part of the storyline of this game was, you know, and something we could talk about, is that the Bills continued to, you know, take field goals. And I thought, you know, when you're playing Kansas City, you really do have to have a bit of a mindset change. And I think you have to be willing to gamble on fourth down in, you know, middle of the field. And you need to score touchdowns and not settle for field goals, because what was happening there was Buffalo would go kick three and KC would go down and score seven. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, it was just a little bit of too much Kansas City offense and maybe the stage being a little bit too big. I felt like it looked to me like that Josh Allen was kind of hyped too much. A lot of his balls were, you know, sailing, and he was just trying to do everything on every play. And, you know, it's a good learning lesson for Buffalo.
Duke, in the case of the mentality, get into games, coaches get a bit nervous, you're feeling the moment. Is that not a philosophical discussion that the Bills coaching staff should have had going in, understanding very likely this isn't about losing, but hey, very likely they're going to put up points here and we got to match them?
100%. And, you know, it was interesting. I looked back because a game that came to my mind, not this past season, but the year before when Baltimore was playing Kansas City. You guys might remember it early in the season. And the Ravens ended up losing by five, but they gambled on fourth down about seven times. They went for two, and they didn't get it. They went for two three different times in that game. And John Harbaugh made the comment. He said, against that team and that offense, it's not really about field position. It's about possession and time of possession and scoring points. And so they kind of went into that game with a mindset of, we're going to simply have to, you know, keep the ball on fourth down, and we're going to have to go for two and score as much as we can. Didn't work out that day, but I think that is the mentality you really do have to have. If Mahomes has all his weapons, you know they're going to likely get to 30, and so you got to find a way to do that too.
All right, can you explain to me how Kansas City can scheme it up so that their best two receivers are not just open? They're open, they're on the move, they're running with the ball. Like Hill and Kelce are open the entire game. How are they able to do that all the time?
You know what? I don't have the, you know, I don't get a chance to see the what they call the all-22 film where you can see above. But, you know, first and foremost, when Buffalo, you know, it's kind of pick your poison with the Chiefs, but Buffalo chose to try to play zone. And the speed of Kansas City, and Tony Romo brought this up, I think it was last weekend, where, you know, we always think about a go route or a streak of straight down the field. But what Kansas City can do with guys like Hill and Coleman is they run across the field full speed and kind of through the zones, and they can sort of take the top off it that way. And they make some plays in the passing game where guys are running diagonally at full speed as well. So, I mean, part of it is just the speed at which they do it. And then with Mahomes' ability to kind of escape and run around. But I think that, you know, with Kansas City, you really do have to figure out, can you get enough pressure on Mahomes to at least make him throw the ball early and not let those longer routes take time to develop?
Do you need a better pass rush? And in the case of the Bills, they're too conservative, where you should be blitzing more to have any chance?
Well, I think so. I mean, if you guys think back to the Tampa-Kansas City game earlier this year, you might remember that Tyreek Hill scored three touchdowns in the first half. I think he had something like 200 yards receiving, all on blitz, all on man coverage, and he just ran past guys. So, you know, there's a way to still bring pressure without giving up, you know, massive plays in the back end. It's really hard to do with Mahomes, but I do think that if you're given a choice, you've got to try to bring pressure and at least make him get the ball off quickly.
All right, before we move to the other game, just on the Bills, because there's a ton of Bills fans here in the area, Bills Mafia. You know, it was a great year overall. I mean, Josh Allen has proven himself. He looks like he is, you know, the future number one quarterback for the next decade. So they're all set there. Lots of other key positions, Diggs, et cetera. As you look at the Bills right now, is there anything they need to do other than just become a year more experienced and add a piece here or there? Or do you think there still is some major work that needs to be done to push that team over the top?
Yeah, no, I think they're an absolutely team on the rise. They've got key playmakers in a lot of the key positions. They're really still quite young, especially on defense. I mean, I think you saw, like a lot of teams, when they get some injuries, they didn't have maybe the depth at the running back position that they would have liked to have had, and that might be one thing they could address. You know, I think teams like last night, I saw what Kansas City did was the typical Belichick thing, which was, let's take away their biggest weapon. And I thought they really did a good job of making Stephon Diggs earn every single yard and didn't have a bunch of catches. So, no, I think they've got playmakers, they've got youth, they've got a great culture in Buffalo, and I think, they're going to be a team that's going to be, you know, on the rise and competing for the next 3-4 years.
All right, we're talking football with Duke Ellington. So let's talk about the other game, because there's so many great you know, this is why I was so ready for game two, and it just felt like a big letdown after all the decisions from game one. But let's start with the elephant in the room, which was the decision by Mike LaFleur, the head coach of the Packers, to go for the field goal just outside of 2 minutes, down by 8 from the 8-yard line of Tampa Bay. We've made our views known on this morning pretty much. Is there any defending it in your estimation?
No, I heard you guys actually early this morning, and I could not have agreed more. And JR, you made the point about it being indefensible, and I could not agree more. And I thought Zimmer made a couple of really good points, and one was the whole comment that Rodgers made, which led us to believe he didn't know if they'd have, or he was assuming they would have 4 downs in that situation. And if that was really the case, then he absolutely needed to run on 3rd down. I mean, it's like the opposite mentality. If you didn't think you had 4 downs, maybe you tried to score a touchdown. But if he had run it, even if he wouldn't have gotten in, they'd have been on the 2 or 3 yard line and made that play much more, simple. But yeah, and the other side of it is the analytics. I read some stuff, you know, last night and this morning that said, oh, it really didn't change the chance of victory by much. But to me, the key point is who's on the other side of the ball. If you're going to give the other team the ball back in that situation after a field goal, are you giving it back to a young quarterback with a coach who doesn't believe in him? Are you going to, you know, so you assume they're just going to run it 3 times and punt, so you will get it back, or are you giving it back to Tom Brady and Bruce Arians? So in that situation, knowing all of those factors and knowing that you've got Aaron Rodgers at the controls, I was absolutely shocked, and I don't think there's anybody today that would suggest that was the right call.
Duke, and I agree, but would you look at it and say, hey, Brady in the second half, 3 picks in a row, not much of a running game going that you did have at least, again, I guess understanding some confidence on the Green Bay side defensively?
Yeah, yes. I mean, I could see that part of the equation, but you're also saying that, and if you look at those interceptions, I heard you guys talk about it a little bit earlier. I mean, the first one was really a bad throw. He threw a sort of a skinny corner route, and he threw it to the inside of the field and didn't get it out towards the sideline. It was just a bad throw. The second one, a little tiny bit high. Evans maybe makes that play, you know, 7 of 10 times, and maybe it doesn't end up in a pick. And the last one was almost a punt. But, yeah, you had a little bit of confidence, I think. But don't forget, too, in the drive previous to that, after the 3 interceptions, they did drive down and kick the field goal. So I just think you're asking an awful lot of a defense to assume that Tom Brady's just going to be, you know, given direction to hand the ball off 3 times and punt it.
All right, so after the decision, Tampa Bay gets the ball. They eventually get it to 3rd down. They're using their timeouts, and, you know, LaFleur is thinking, okay, maybe I have made the right decision here. And then we get the call, the pass interference call, which essentially allows Tampa Bay to, they get a 1st down, and they're able to run out the clock, and Green Bay never gets the ball back. Considering how the game had been officiated, yep, did you think that was an appropriate call?
You know what? Referees are trained and taught. Now, you know, a lot of pass interference we know is subjective, and it's hand fighting, and it's, you know, is the ball catchable, and did the guy really impede him? All those kinds of questions that referees are asked to make decisions on in a split second. But a couple of things are all trained to sort of look for that are non-negotiables. One is, you know, the extension of the arm when somebody pushes off. If they can see that arm being extended in a push off, they'll get called either way. And if you see a defensive back grabbing the receiver's jersey and it comes away from the body, that also needs to be called. Now, on the Tampa Bay interception just before the first half, the kid did the same thing. Now, very, very quickly, it wasn't nearly as obvious, but it didn't get called, and I think that was the point everybody was really struggling with, was how come after all that hand-fighting that went on all day on both sides, that gets called in the most key point. But when you saw it in, you know, even in slow motion, obviously it's easier, but when you saw how long that jersey was hung on to and sort of the distance it was pulled off the guy's body, the referee really had no choice.
Can you explain to me? And I had no issue with the way the game overall. If they're gonna allow guys to so-called, you know, play it out or whatever, I've no issue with that. But then we see games, Duke, in which we see flags on everything. Yep. Do officiating crews get together ahead of a game and say, "Hey boys, we're gonna call everything today"? Or would that group yesterday have gone, "Hey boys, championship game, we gotta let them play"? Like that's always the difficulty I have, is the inconsistency, not within a game, but over the entirety of a game, and how it's inconsistent from game to game.
It's a great point. And what's really interesting is that, year over year and sort of season over season, there are crews that have statistically called, you know, way higher percentage of penalties than other crews. So I don't know if it is the head referee's kind of oversight and how he thinks the game should be officiated. I don't know how much comes down from the league, but we see normally in almost every sport, as the stakes of the game get higher. Now, usually you've got better teams playing it too, right? Which means the need for penalties goes down a little bit. But it's absolutely a great question, and one of the true mysteries of the NFL, how some games you can see flags flying for every ticky-tack play, and other times it just seems to get left. And all of us, I think, would agree with you that at the end of the day, you want the players to decide it. And if you draw a line in the sand early to say, "This is how we're going to officiate it," you just want it to be consistent for 60 minutes.
Duke, I know in the National Hockey League there's times the ref will say, "Hey, a couple of guys are opening faceoffs, going to let you play, you set a tone." Would it be up to the individual clubs to know who the crew is and know what type of game they like to officiate and how?
Absolutely, 100%. The guys do know that, and it should factor in. Now, I know this year it's just been interesting because, of course, COVID has a lot of impact on the game and the players, but it also, you know, did limit the amount of referee training and in-person stuff that they could do as well. And I read a stat this morning that I think that penalties in general were down, I wanted to say about 20%, and offensive holding penalties were down the most by percentage compared to last year. So that kind of dictates why we saw so much scoring this year as well. But yes, the coaches should and are aware of head referees and their crews and kind of what to expect given, you know, the history of that particular crew.
So you no doubt, like all football fans, heard the comments of Aaron Rodgers after the game. He was very wistful, said, you know, paraphrasing his words, you know, no one's quite sure from year to year what's going to, you know, and made it sound like, yeah, I'm not sure I'm going to be back or not. Aaron Rodgers always says stuff, and there's always a hidden meaning to all of it. This guy is not a fool. So what did you make of his comments, and do you think there's a chance he's not back with the Packers next season?
Well, you know what, you're right about that. I mean, Aaron Rodgers is pretty intentional with what he says to the media and how he says it. So you have to, you know, I think he's one of those intelligent athletes that we all appreciate and enjoy listening to because he doesn't just do the typical athlete speak. But I felt like yesterday a little bit was, the emotion of the moment. I think he's just really, really distraught after another opportunity like that slips through his fingers. So I don't really necessarily think he was suggesting that he wants out. I do find sometimes that he tends to divert blame a little bit, and he tends to make other people in the organization a little uncomfortable with some of the things that he says. So that's something they're going to have to work through. And certainly at the very end, he must have felt yesterday that in the key moment of the entire season, my coach took the ball out of my hands. And that's got to be hard to stomach for me.
And the way the season started, Duke, excuse was first-round picks used on a quarterback. Man, you can't believe you're doing this. Asset management embarrassing me. And then to finish off the season the way you did, is this a guy that deserves, you know, more criticism for not delivering? I don't care that it's a team sport.
Yep.
You've got to beat Tom Brady yesterday based on where this is at in your career.
Well, and I heard you guys talk about it earlier, and I felt the same way a little bit. It felt like the entire you know, state of Wisconsin was nervous yesterday going into that game. It just felt like that they just there was so much riding on it. They had so much going for them. It felt like they were just tight all day long, really, at the end of the day. But no, I've been that way a little bit with Rodgers. I feel like he does escape some criticism, and his record, as great a player as he has been with some really good weapons over the years, to have only gotten, you know, one Super Bowl out of that is, you know, it's not good enough. And I think he does sometimes escape criticism. And, you know, I do agree that, I mean, if you think back when he got drafted, it was a similar situation. So he, among more than anybody else, should have understood the premise, which was, we've got a starting quarterback who's in his late 30s. Nothing lasts forever. We need a succession plan, just like we did with Favre. And, you know, Aaron, you were that guy, whatever, 15, 20 years ago. So why are you so upset now that the organization's doing the same thing? So I just find it quite fascinating. But I don't think all of that should or would lead to him leaving Green Bay next year.
Mike Pettine, the Packers defensive coordinator, is certainly getting a lot of criticism for the defense that he called the man defense at the end of the first half that allowed Brady to hit the bomb. And the touchdown, that was a real backbreaking play in that game, and even the lead up to it.
Wow.
What you know, like we saw Greg Williams got fired, and a lot of Packer fans want Pettine fired. Why would a defensive coordinator make that call, given 8 seconds left, no timeouts, they're at the 39-yard line? Like everything said, you know, deep is the deepest, be conservative, all that. Why would he call that?
You know what? It was absolutely fascinating to watch, because as I was watching, I felt a little bit like Tony Romo, but I was about a second late. But when you saw the alignment of the receivers on that play, right away I thought, okay, Miller is going to run about a 4-yard outcut and get, you know, 5-6 more yards so they can kick the field goal. As soon as he left the line of scrimmage and there was no, you could see that there was no other receiver going to be coming underneath, and he just went straight up the field, I said, they're going to go for a touchdown. And Green Bay, there was only one thing that could hurt you in that situation, and that was, you know, a touchdown, or because if they completed the ball in the field of play with no timeouts, that was going to be the end of the half. So what you needed to do there, to your point, was to play off and you know, defend the sideline and defend the goal line. And they did neither of those things. So if Miller had wanted to run a 6-yard out, he could have just as easily, because the defensive back was not shading that way. So absolute mystery to me, especially after you realize that Tampa had come off the field, they were going to punt it. They came back and they went for it and got the first down. And then you knew that, you know, the only one play that could really, really hurt you was, you know, exactly what happened. So I have no idea what they were doing, especially because the kid that was guarding Miller is not even by far their best defender.
Right.
So they put him in a real tough position.
Yeah. At the same time, though, I mean, even if you call man, you've got to be thinking as a player. And look, I understand the criticism of the call. But as a player, you've got to be saying to yourself, okay, they've called man. I don't know why, coach, but you've called man. Mm-hmm. You've still got to say to yourself, I can't let this. The one thing I can't do is let this guy get behind me.
Exactly.
And I feel Miller's, like the player kind of skates on this a little bit because of that.
For sure. No, and it was terrible design, but you're right, it was sort of terrible technique as well. I mean, Scotty Miller, from a scouting standpoint, you know he's not Mike Evans. He's not a physical big, you know, guy that's going to go out. He's just a burner, and the only one thing that he can do is run real fast. So you may want to be aware of that when number 10 lines up on your side in that situation.
All right, we need to update the Pico Pizza Cup.
Yes.
The standings going into the weekend were JR in front. What did I have, Hammer, 24?
You had 24 heading in to Championship Sunday.
Simmer had 23.
Yes, sir.
Duke at 16.
Nice.
And you are at 14?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and how many points are up for grabs for each of the predictions?
We had 3, six for each game, so yep. 12 for the week.
12 were up for grabs. We were doing straight up and versus the spread. Now, of course, I am offering up the Pico Pizza Cup, so I cannot win. So there was really no use in me trying to correctly predict, because I can't win. And so when I went 0-for, it's not, you know what, I really should be pat. It's hard to go 0-for on a day, but I did that, so way to go me. What are the rest of the standings, the picks?
Yeah, you got 0 in both games. Congratulations. So you stick on 24, but
yes,
that is good enough to stick in second place.
Oh,
all right? I got 6 points because I had Tampa Bay and the points correct. Those are the only points I got.
So you move up to 20?
I move up to 20. Duke, with the same picks as myself, great minds think alike, with 6. So he moves up to 22. Right. Simmer had the early game hammered with the Chiefs and the -3.5. Sorry, the evening game, Chiefs -3.5, 0 with the Packers. So he moves up to 29,
yep,
taking over first place from you, JR.
All right, we got him right where we want him, though. Everybody can draft. And with the amount of points up for grabs, anyone can win the Pico Pizza Cup based on the Super Bowl, right? Because multiple points will be up for grabs.
Duke also had an idea, too, that Simmer I also heard expressed earlier in the morning. Don't know if he's going to stick to it on the air. And that is adding the over-under into the mix
love
as
it.
Well.
Oh, yeah. I love it. Yeah.
15 points up for grabs.
And the length of the national anthem. We got to bet on that, of course.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, some props. Right?
Some coin toss.
Giselle sightings.
Yeah, so perfect. All right, Duke, always appreciate the insight, my friend. We will chat again on the Friday before the Super Bowl coming up in a couple of weeks.
I will study hard.
All right, thanks, bud.
Thanks, guys. Right, have a great week.
There, you too. There's Duke Ellingson joining us on the Gabriel Pizza Hotline. Make Gabriel Pizza your big game headquarters. Order online at GabrielPizza.com. Nice job, Simmer. Got the lead. Always tough to sleep on the lead. And you got to sleep for 13 days on the lead.
Yeah, and we'll have some fun with that. But it was funny watching it, JR, because I was thinking, man, wish I had been bold and bullish on my Bucks and talking up Tom Brady. So, hey, lots of fun. And, man, that's the beautiful, the National Football League, right? And, like, we love our ice hockey. But, you know, for most, even, we cover it. By the time you get to a Stanley Cup final, it's like, oh, okay, this is fine. You know, baseball, I don't even care about it anymore unless it's the Blue Jays. Basketball, even with the Lakers in. National Football League, just a different animal, right? Like both of those games, the cross-reference and excitement it has, and now it's setting up for one hell of a Super Bowl as well.
All right. We are getting set for a Sens game day here on TSN 1200 as they're in Vancouver to take on the Canucks at 10 o'clock. 8 o'clock will be our pregame show. We'll get you share some thoughts ahead of that game as Ottawa tries to break its four-game losing streak. We'll get to this day in sports history and celebrate some sports and hockey birthdays as well as we roll on here for a Monday morning. You're listening to Sports Radio TSN 1200. It's Monday morning. JR, Simmer, and Hammer coming up top of the hour. AJ Jakubek, Michaela Schreider is back in. She will co-host In the Box between 10 and 2 today. This afternoon, it's Steve and Lee on the drive. Tonight, 8 o'clock, Graham Creech has your pregame show. 10 o'clock, late night. Dean Brown, Gord Wilson will have the call of the Sens and the Canucks. We should find out this afternoon if there's going to be some lineup changes for the Sens. Cedric Paquette left the game on Saturday, lower body injury. So if you think, all right, Paquette will be out, there's no way. Simmer, there's no way they're dressing Haley again, are they? No, JR, come on. No. So that's two changes, okay? Like Josh Brown, without having his name mentioned, seemed to get called out by the coach for the turnover, which led to the tying goal in the third period. Yeah. They've talked about how old Zuby Dooby Doo, Artem Zub, who's going to see some action.
Yeah.
So here's what I'm saying. I'm saying old Artie.
Yeah.
Artie is in for Brown. This is the change I would make. Artie for Brown.
Artie Zub. Okay.
Artie Zub.
We can't be doubling up on an Artie party.
No. Okay. No. There's we need a hat trick of Arties on this team. All right. Then it's going to be Colin White is coming in for the injured Paquette.
Yeah.
And Timmy Stützle is back off the injured list, and he comes in for Haley. And there you go. There's the three changes I would want to see tonight.
Yeah, I would assume. I don't know where Galchenyuk, what you want to end up doing. Do not look at Vancouver and think they present anything as far as real physicality. So, hey, go with your best possible lineup, and I hope Wolanin's back in.
Can't take him. He had a good game.
Oh, well, again, that's what I stay the course. Should not come out again this year. Just play him. Play him. Increase. It's been like what Zaitsev has obviously done so far. For the Zoo. But I agree with all your changes. This is more, I don't know. I can't eat. Well, there's no way a coach sits there and listens to social media and the media and does the opposite. But it does start to make you wonder at times. And again, this is a delicate part of the relationship between Pierre Dorion and DJ Smith is great, but you've also given all the power to a second-year NHL head coach to make all the personnel decisions, JR. And as I said, I don't care who you are, anybody I've worked with, you sit down, and it's just a healthy exchange between the manager and coach, and just ask some questions philosophically. Don't force anything, but the idea to hand the keys over and think for a minute that he's not finding his way as a coach, and when it comes to personnel decisions, I would certainly be helping out if I was a general manager.
Yeah, and I'm not saying for a minute that an NHL head coach should ever listen to the media and or the fans about who should play and who shouldn't play.
Oh, okay? No, of course not.
It's up to us to bray at the moon as much as we want. Doesn't make a difference. You should play who you think should play.
Yeah,
that being said, it was interesting. I listened to his comments, the post-game show, DJ Smith's comments after the game on Saturday, And eventually the talk turned to just, you know, what's up with Paquette? He's injured or whatever. And then he kind of went on. And at the end, he threw in a little nugget, which I found kind of interesting.
Okay.
Words to the effect of, for those wondering why Paquette is playing, and then he went into what he's done on the penalty kill, that he has been in Ottawa's penalty kill the night before, had been 7 for 7, et cetera, et cetera. So, I'm not saying that he's listening to the radio or he's reading social media. But I think we're naive if we don't think that word doesn't filter, whether he's talking to his wife, whether it's even Pierre Dorion saying, hey, listen, the knobs on the radio on TSN 1200 are saying you're making some bad lineup decisions here, or the fans are saying, come on, start dressing some kids. We'd be naive to think that they haven't acknowledged that he's not aware of some people are questioning the lineup decisions.
Yeah, I don't know. And, you know, to me, certainly this is an approach.
I'm going with it.
Okay. And then I'm saying for my job, hey, I never couldn't care less. What I do know is I've never seen the Sens fan bases engaged on Twitter. Even the third round of the Stanley Cup a few years ago, JR, people are really interested. And this is the other part. When you look at that coaching staff, the other two assistants, very respectful, have both been head coaches in the NHL. Do I doubt for a minute that you sit and go through a lineup and philosophically you're trying to do the right things? Totally. Like, I don't think this is some sabotage job or somebody trying to be all of a sudden very defensive. But when you go through that and then you say, well, now I want to have Artie in the lineup. Well, I can't explain that one because I'll be honest with you. He doesn't do anything for you. But if you want to go and pick through a lineup, well, I want to be bigger on the back end. You know what you end up with? That's where you need somebody to sit down and say, I appreciate as a coach, you're diligent in what you're doing. Individually, you're explaining this to me. But let's go through the sum of the parts here. And what are you addressing? You're addressing an older, slower lineup and you're addressing big on the back end with not enough skill. So let's get over that. Do you know what I mean? And that can be totally where coaches need help, where you're in there. These guys sounds like they put in long hours. They work their asses off. But you can step in and sometimes and say, listen, man, listen, we understand that. But we can't have this where it's him and then to Watson and Nisimov is in. And then in the back end, you're going to have Josh Brown with Gabranson and Coburn. Let's start looking bigger picture here. First of all, this has nothing to do with development of the kids. Because I'll be honest with you, JR, from the Norris line to Paul to basically Shabbat and Wolan, and I'm not worried about these guys. Like, I'm not worried that, you know, I've got to support them and have all these veteran guys and all this toughness around them. They're fine. What you're really worrying about is some really bad veteran players. You know, some of them are just flat out either not NHL players or very marginal at that.
Would it be fair to say that, you know, part of the general manager's job, these healthy discussions, as you call it, he should have regularly with the coach about the lineup is that sometimes the coaching staff cannot see the forest for the trees.
Absolutely. And you'd also go back.
You get in the weeds can't get out of it.
And then again, I totally know that Pierre Dorion, whether it be with Boucher and with Smith, you want to sit down in the offseason and you go with your team and you sit it with your coaches. I've been in the meeting chair. You want to deliver the players. But second time around, learning what you did, and I keep using this term and I've used it, you don't want to create roadblocks for your young players. And by the time this offseason ended, first of all, the volume of players coming in, and I know they got a second-round pick from Tampa Bay. You told me right now, though, I could avoid having Paquette and Coburn around versus a second-round pick. I would have never made that trade. Now you've made to step on to, you know, Nisimov is back. Next thing you know, Austin Watson, I got to have Brown, I got Gabranson, I got all these guys. I would just steer clear of making some of these moves. And then I'll be quite honest with you, very, very early on, my eye test tells me that Hogberg's going to be the better goaltender going forward. I know it's a very bold statement. That's just me. Dadanov has just been okay. The series of moves in the offseason that the Ottawa Senators have made, albeit minor or short term, I don't think you're looking at any of them right now and thinking, wow, that was genius. That looks like a whole lot of clutter. They just have to be quite simply thankful the drafting of Mr. Mann.
Right. Yeah. Nothing has been a home run so far.
No, sure. And again, I don't want to get into, I'm trying to compare with Montreal, and Montreal will go out and make trades because the general manager is trying to save his job. So I know the mentality of, if I'm trading out Galchenyuk, I don't want to get futures necessarily. I want a player. I'm trading out Domi. I want Anderson. But when you look at that and you look at Ottawa's side where, okay, in the short term here, they're going to have great players via the draft. Norris is a nice part of the trade. Tierney's come in. But then when you look, as I said, with Stone to Hoffman to Duchesne, to try to look through that, even Zibanejad to Brassard-Jair, there's not a single asset in your lineup from those four trades. And we will, in a month, it'll be 2 years since that Mark Stone trade was made and the Duchesne trade and a lot of those other moves. That's a long time, boy. And when you kind of start to parse through it, there are a lot more misses on the pro side than there are hits. And like I said, that's why a big part of this rebuild is the draft. And that's also where you have to be patient, because if you're going to rely completely on that, you're talking a 5 or 6 year process.
Right. Oh, by the way, Shane Pinto had 2 more goals last night, and Jake Sanderson had 2 assists in another North Dakota win. So, Pinto, I saw you going back and forth with Brad Schlossman, who we've had on. Brad covers the team out in Grand Forks, and asking about Pinto potentially being a Hobie Baker candidate this year.
So. No, it really is. That is, you see his numbers. And
I think he's got 8 goals and 19 points, I believe, so far this year.
Yeah, and a point a game at the college level, and he's a little bit ahead of that. Oh, that's just outstanding. And for
as
what
a sophomore,
he's, and that would point to, and I think we've all said between he and JBD for sure, when the season's end, come in, hopefully get some games, and would not be shocked at all if Jake Sanderson turns pro as well.
Homer Hugh in Hogsback has drawn his line in the sand for tonight's game. Here we go. If Anisimov is in the lineup tonight, Homer Hugh, not watching. If Colin White and Christian Willannon are healthy scratches tonight, not watching. If Michael Haley is in the lineup tonight, not watching. So we'll take that text, we'll forward that on to the Sens out in Vancouver, and we'll see if DJ Smith fashions his lineup to make sure that Homer Hugh is not watching tonight with any of those four decisions.
Yeah, I'm watching Haley on Saturday night, and I kept thinking his nickname must be Teapot, because I'm thinking short and stout, right? He's just cruising around, and he's actually, you can see where, you know what, strong guy, smart positionally, and get around a little bit.
Good in the room.
Not a whole lot of skill.
Good
in the
room.
Like I say, this whole reverse of, I don't know if code has changed, JR. Boileau gets beat up by Tkachuk, and then somehow he has to fight the other team's tough guy. Okay. Please explain that to me.
This text comes in and just says simply, sometimes you are what you are. And maybe that's just the best way to put the state of the Sens right now.
Yeah.
All right. Let's get to this day in sports history, shall we? At 9:49, this 25th day of January. Hang on. Get through my notes here. All right. Here we go. On this day in 1924, seems fitting. Because I got some reports from people in the West End. It's already snowing in the West End, making its way across the city.
Ooh.
First ever Winter Olympics began on this day in Chamonix, France.
Nice.
In 1924.
Yeah, we were just talking about Lake Placid, right, JR? The small centers. And think of all those cool places from Squaw Valley to St. Moritz and different places. Must have been a whole lot of fun back in the day. Not to mention a little bit of outdoor ice hockey back then, right?
Yes, absolutely. Right? On this day in 1975, our good friend of the show, Denny Potvin, NHL Hall of Famer, had his first NHL hat trick as a defenseman. Yeah, well, they're fairly rare anyway, but Denny Potvin, first hat trick on this day.
Yeah,
Denny probably listening up in Wakefield, right?
Yeah, and the patience of that time, JR, to wait for the Montreal Canadiens era to end and start going for some Stanley Cups come 1980.
On this day in 1981 in Super Bowl 15, the Oakland Raiders beat the Philadelphia Eagles 27-10 thanks to MVP Jim Plunkett.
Wow.
The quarterback of the Raiders back on this day 30 years ago.
Are we talking Ron Jaworski?
Old Jaws.
Oh,
yeah,
wow,
absolutely.
Yeah. Cool uniforms back then, too.
Oh, man.
They solid
silver
helmet.
Wings.
Oh, yeah. Very solid helmet logo.
On this day in 1986, Paul Coffey set a record, an NHL record for defenseman point streak. How many games in a row did Paul Coffey score a point in to set this record?
32.
28, so good guess on that. But think, of course, that's the high-flying Oilers.
Oh, God.
Back, but can you think about a defenseman scoring in 28 straight games?
No, hard to comprehend. Even as great as Erik Karlsson was here, certainly their power play at even strength, how often that first pass, as great a skater he was, JR, probably that first pass led to a lot of second assists as well.
On this day in 1987, the New York Football Giants beat the Denver Broncos 39-20. To win their first Super Bowl, Phil Simms was the MVP of that game. I believe he went 22-25 in the game.
Oh, wow.
All right, on this day, and I don't want to talk anymore about Phil Simms. On this day, or the Giants, on this day in 1991, 30 years ago today, Brett Hull scored goals number 49 and 50 of the season in his 49th game. He became the third NHLer behind Wayne Gretzky and Mario Lemieux to get 50 goals in less than 50 games.
Yeah, amazing accomplishment. And I was at the game, or doing TV actually for Washington at the time, JR, when Cam Neely ended up getting the 50 goals, but they didn't allow him to have the record, right? Because he had been injured to start the season.
Yeah,
you remember that?
So. Yes.
But
yes.
That was unbelievable watching him literally playing on one leg, had that calcified quad situation. There was a unlucky trend back, and I guess a lot of people thought was from the Ulf Samuelsson days, but yeah, that was incredible to watch the guts that he played with on one leg.
On this day in 1995, the Chicago Blackhawks opened the United Center before a crowd of 20,833. They became the first team in history to draw an average of over 20,000 fans a game. I have not been to the United Center. It's a huge building, right?
Oh,
it's 22,000.
It's a spaceship.
Like, when you're way up at the top, like, you're so far away from the ice, it's useless to be there?
No, you know what? The distance to there doesn't feel like a ton different than the CTC, JR. It might be a little bit higher. It's just for a lot of years when that building was empty, it was just like a spaceship where they have all these suites. So you can imagine like the Death Star when there's nobody in there and there's just all these lights and suites and it just looks like a ginormous building. And he also came out of right across the street, the old United Center, you know, and how old and you know, but no, it doesn't necessarily feel like that, but it is a massive, massive place.
On this day in 1996, the Ottawa Senators set a dubious NHL record with their 16th consecutive home a game without a win. They went 0-15-1 and lost to Detroit at the Palladium, which had just opened, of course. The old record of 15 was shared by old-timey Chicago Blackhawks and old-timey Montreal Canadiens. Those were the dark days. That's when they were just starting to turn the corner with Jacques Martin and company. On this day in 1998, Super Bowl 22, the Denver Broncos beat the Green Bay Packers 31-24. Terrell Davis was the MVP. Was that the one where John Elway does the run and he gets hit near the goal line and he ends up doing the kind of
spin? Oh, he
does
the full flip? Oh, okay.
Was it that? They played in two in a row, right? I think it was that one. Quite sure.
Yeah, and Terrell Davis, here and gone, right? Short career, blew up both knees, and the rest is history.
Yep. On this day in 2014, the NHL played outdoor hockey in Southern California. The Anaheim Ducks beat the LA Kings 3-0 before a crowd of 54,000 at Dodger Stadium.
Yeah, and you go to that climate, JR, long as the temperature's not bad, which in the winter it isn't, very dry, pretty good way to make ice. Not like when they tried Vegas playing, or in Vegas, they had the Rangers and the Kings. I think that year they played in Vegas in September outdoors. That was not going to go well. Tough to make ice back then.
On this day in 2015, listen, the ship had already sailed on the NHL All-Star Game. But in 2015, Team Taze beat Team Foligno 17-12. The combined 29 goals set an All-Star Game record, surpassing the previous high of 26 set in 2001.
Yeah.
It already was ridiculous at that point.
Yeah, I tried different formats, and I'm having shades of, was John Scott the MVP, Jared?
Was he? I don't know.
But they went to the 3-on-3, and yeah, nothing has really worked. And at the end of the day, when it was here in Ottawa, boy, it was just a fun weekend. Fun weekend to celebrate at a local level.
Yes, if it's in your town, it's great.
Yeah, absolutely.
Other than that. And on this day, 2019, so this will be the last time we had an NHL All-Star weekend, because last year was it canceled last? No, maybe it wasn't. Anyway. 2 years ago, that was the year that Kendall Coyne Schofield replaced Nathan MacKinnon in the fastest skater contest and blazed around in 14.34 seconds. She did not beat Connor McDavid, but nobody loses to Connor McDavid. She did beat Clayton Keller of the Arizona Coyotes, and what a show she put on that night.
Yeah, that was a great spectacle, opportunity for people to see how good women's hockey is. And she's now doing TV, is it, for San Jose?
I think she's moved to the Hawks now, I want to say.
Oh, is she? Oh,
yeah,
okay.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I think
so. Some nice opportunities.
Yeah, and NBC as well.
Yeah.
Sports birthdays, we'll quickly roll through them. Former Ottawa Rough Riders quarterback Condridge Holloway, born on this day in 1954, which would make him 67, I believe.
That old, wow.
Yeah. Celebrating his 51st birthday today, you see him on the TSN panel, former great receiver in the CFL. Milt Stegall is 51. Man, that guy's in great shape. Holy
cow. On a couple of car commercials now. As far as Condridge Holloway, just a little trivia for you, JR.
Yes.
Do you remember what school he went to in the United States?
Condridge Holloway went to Tennessee.
Yeah, that was the great controversy back in the day, right, of wanting him to turn pro in the NFL and end up being a receiver and said, nope, going to Canada.
Born on this day in 1973. Now the coach of the Edmonton football team is Scott Milanovich, right? Coached the Argos to the Grey Cup. Went down, became the quarterback's coach in Jacksonville, and has now made his way back to the Edmonton football team, which should be getting a nickname sometime soon.
Yeah, come up with something.
Hockey birthdays. Hey, our good friend Jared Cowan, 30 years old today. Wow. He's old Jared. think he's living out west somewhere. I believe Saskatoon, I believe.
Yeah, hopefully sock some dough away because he wouldn't have thought. And again, I thought when he first came into the league was a good defenseman. I know the Minnesota people at the time thought he was going to be tremendous.
How much do you think the knee injury affected him at the end of the day?
Well, the knee was a little bit, but I think there were some hip issues as well. Was the knee what happened when you went down to Binghamton during the lockout chair? Or was it hip? But he there was a loss, and again, you started to see a different league. Also not the best hockey sense of the world, but for sure it did. I didn't mind his pivot back in 2011, and he pretty much lost the rest, and don't think he expected, even going to Toronto, that there's a bit of a grievance there. Got a buyout and hasn't made a dollar since.
Also celebrating a birthday today on this January 25th. He's 66. He was the first head coach of the modern-day Ottawa Senators and now head coach of the Dallas Stars. Rick Bones Bonus, 66 years old today.
Yeah, what a journey he's had, right? And a lot of people last year cheering and hoping. Old Bones and Judy. Remember Judy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Judy getting an opportunity to raise the cup.
Yeah. Also celebrating a birthday today, so he is turning 59. Chris Chelios, 1,651 games over 26 seasons. He won 3 cups with the Habs and the Wings and 3 Norris trophies as well. Played till he was, what, 48?
It was at least. And, boy, he liked to party, and they thought in Montreal he partied too much. Flipped him out for Denny Savard. Terrible trade. Great trade by Mike Keenan. I still remember when he was traded to Detroit. It was at a trade deadline, and there was a Swedish defenseman that didn't really turn out that Detroit sent to Chicago along with some picks, and he thought, oh, this will be short term. Goes on and plays another 8 or 9 years in Detroit. Pretty shocking, and one of my favorite moves ever. One of the few defensemen, when the puck would come along the boards, he'd switch hands, right? He'd end up switching to the opposite hand and hold the puck in. It was pretty cool.
All I remember was the story about him was that, he stayed in great shape, obviously. Yeah, he played late in your 40s. Did he not skate around all the time with garbage bags, the internal heater?
Well, not only garbage bags, but when you'd come into the locker room, JR, he would be in the sauna on the stationary bike. So if you want to bring your weight down.
I like a good sauna myself.
Yeah,
sauna,
yeah.
That seems
on the bike.
Yeah.
Like I could sit on the bike in the sauna, but I would not be rotating the pedals.
Last but not least, the only man in the world that speaks Ticanese. Esa Tikkanen is 56 today. Won 4 Stanley Cups, 3 with the Oilers, 1 with the Rangers. Yeah. He actually did 3 different tours of duty with New York. You want to talk about all-time characters, right?
Yeah.
Did you have him in Washington for a
bit? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And we ended up bringing him in. First of all, maybe the right there with Adam Oates as far as hockey sense on one leg. 3 parts of old Tiki Talk coming in. When we cleared town after we went to the finals, could not locate his rental car, which was never found. The bar tab at the hotel was $15,000, which is, hey, nothing wrong with settling a little something else. And also when we played Ottawa was staying in the same hotel in D.C. Old Tick, during one of the days there, they were having their pregame meal. He actually went into the Ottawa room, sat with the team and had a bite to eat and then left. So you talk about getting into someone's kitchen back in the day. Hey, yeah. He was a character and a half. Yeah.
Game 7 overtime winner to beat Calgary in the 91 playoffs.
That was like found Edmonton. Money for Edmonton, right, back in the day, where he, I think, had played in Regina, and he was a handful with the drinking back then, but he was that next little layer, an absolute super pest that came into that lineup. But as I said, it was really amazing, JR. I've been on, again, another player on one leg, just to watch the intelligence that he had. What a gift.
All right. If you are celebrating your birthday today on this 25th of January, happy birthday to you.